This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free Blackstone 8-piece accessory kit when you buy a Blackstone 28-inch griddle. Plus, get two free select Craftsman V20 tools when you buy an RP brushless drill and impact driver combo kit. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
I know your game, Patrick. This is war. From now on, consider yourself an endangered species.
You're listening to Midsummer Murders Mayhem, the official podcast for the hit global television series Midsummer Murders. I'm your host, Nikki Chapman. In this podcast, I get to examine the Midsummer Murders television series in audio form, one nail-biting episode at a time. Spoiler alert, we leave no stone unturned, no evidence unchecked. So if you haven't seen the episode in question today, I suggest you do it right now. We're going back to season 14 with a rare bird. A row between keen bird watchers in Midsummer in the Marsh turns very nasty when their president is killed. Patrick Morgan met his death while hoping to sight a rare bird, but is his obsession with ornithology to blame, or something rather more sinister? With the help of cast, crew, and devoted superfans, I'll be covering some of the most important scenes, discussing the most intriguing characters, and seeing who can spot those cameos. Helping me on this episode will be Bill Young. Bill is Vice President of Television Programming for PBS in North Texas. Bill also writes passionately about British television and culture. He is my perfect companion.
You know, the only thing that we didn't have is somebody die before the opening credits, but you know it's coming pretty soon.
This week, we're hearing from Jason Hughes, otherwise known as DS Ben Jones.
I just showed up in a uniform and somebody said, well, where's the guy? And they were, oh, he's sick. And that was it. He was gone and I was in.
Plus, we'll finish things off with a round of our superfan face-off quiz, hosted by award-winning Scottish comedian, actor, presenter and, most importantly, die-hard Midsummer Murders enthusiast. Yes, it's Ashley Story.
How much does the ice cream van charge Jones for two 99s? Bobby.
A penny. Oh, wait.
No.
Oh, it says...
With the cost of dairy in this country, no, it's not a penny.
Also, be sure to stick around for the end where we tie up any of those loose ends, wrap everything up, announce exactly who committed the murderous crimes, and how Barnaby solved them. Hello, Bill. Let's get moving. We've chosen a rare bird. Neil Dudgeon said it was his top 10 favourite episode.
You know, Nikki, I have to say that I didn't know a lot about bird watching, but now after watching Rare Bird, I believe I know quite a bit now.
That's good.
And in this particular episode, members of the Midsummer in the Marsh Ornithological Society, thankfully referred to as the MMOS, have a fallout. And that's when Ralph Ford claims that he has spotted the rare blue-crested hoopoe. Now, the sighting puts him ahead in this year's list competition, but as MMOS president Patrick Morgan says, the bird could never have been seen in Midsummer as it's native to Uganda.
So he's infuriated, isn't he, Ralph? And
yeah.
He storms out of the meeting. And then, yeah, lots of heated words, shall we say. And then the next day, Patrick is found dead in Swansdown Lake, the scene of the alleged hoopoe sighting. Now, when they pull his body from the lake, it's entangled in a mist net used to catch and release birds. And he sustained several, well, very, very nasty blows to the head, which have caused his death.
The dead man's wife, Nina, which is a former Russian prima ballerina, had recently become pregnant. Now, before his death, Patrick Morgan accused Nina of sleeping with another man, so Midsummer, professing it to be impossible that she be pregnant.
I'm pregnant. What? Well, it's impossible. You can't be.
Oh, yes, yes, the test was positive. And
whose?
What do you mean?
Whose is it?
Patrick, you're hurting me.
I'll kill you. You hear me? I'll kill you.
What's the matter?
That's not a great start, is it, to the show? I'll kill you.
No.
Now, a bird alert sent from Ralph Ford's phone had lured the now deceased Morgan to the scene of the crime. Ford, a professional taxidermist, of course, claims his phone was stolen. And Tim Whitley, while birdwatching, incidentally captured the sound of Morgan's attack on the stroke of midnight.
Well, how appropriate. You have a taxidermist in a birdwatching episode. And then I thought it was very strange to actually send the text from your own phone. Thankfully, he claimed it was stolen.
Very odd.
Olivia Carter, which was secretary of the MMOS and receptionist to Dr. Markham, who's another member of the MMOS, seems very traumatized, obviously, by Patrick's death, while the belligerent farmer George Napier is, thankfully, he's glad to be rid of the former city financier while expressing pity for the beautiful widow.
Now, Dr. Kate Wilding reveals that Patrick had a vasectomy. Nina's child then couldn't have been his. Oh, no. Nina explained she had a drunken fling at a party in London, but Jones is convinced that her lover is a local man. Could he be a member of the MMOS or even Dave Foxley, the local but very good-looking bad boy?
You're not going ahead with that.
Oh, yeah.
Drain the mead and you'll drain my wetlands. They are habitat to several birds with protected status.
It's my living that needs protecting, not them birds.
I'll sue you if I have to.
Do what you like. You ain't the only cock and crow. Damn birds.
Chicken plucking so-and-so. He's not a nappy bunny. Got problems indoors with a wife.
Ain't getting his rations.
Whatever. You better turn the volume down. It's the doctor quacks loudest. Get shot.
I love that local bad boy. Every village needs a bad boy, especially Midsummer in the Marsh.
I love that. He ain't getting his rations. Bill, I don't have to explain what that means, do I?
I've never said it that way, but you don't have to explain that. I think it's self-explanatory. But Patrick is just not setting himself up well with the local town.
No. And I don't know, the farmer's just got away, isn't it? Ducks that quack the loudest get shot. I mean, already they're setting it up. We've got a couple of issues here, haven't we? We've got Patrick threatening to kill his wife, Nina. And then obviously we can see this contretemps with the farmer and also with Dave Foxley as well. So starts off pretty heavy, pretty heated.
Yeah, the only thing that we didn't have is somebody die before the opening credits. But you know it's coming pretty soon.
It is. But we've got to get into this bird matter, haven't we? Because we're talking about the Midsummer in the Marsh Ornithological Society, easy for some to say. And this is where it all gets, well, it does start to kick off.
Ralph has claimed that he saw a blue-crested hoodoo.
It's not a claim. I saw the bloody thing. A mega.
Were you alone at the time?
Yes.
Then it's unverifiable, as Patrick says.
What have happened to Bird's honour? My word is my bond.
Nobody's questioning your word, Ralph.
Yes, he is! And why? Because this sighting gives me a 10-point lead in this year's list competition. 10 points ahead of you, Patrick. That's what this is all about. I know your game, Patrick. This is war. From now on, consider yourself an endangered species.
So, Bill, in a way now, the scene has been set. We've heard all the party in the upstairs room at the pub deciding on how many points people should or shouldn't get for this blue-crested hoopoe, which has been spotted. And, yeah, tempers are frayed, words are said, and threats are made. Oh, yes, it's getting serious.
Well, I had no idea that it was this serious, that there were points, there were any, you've got rules as to, you know, when you can see something, do you have a witness, all of that.
They're so fanatical. But you can tell that Ralph and Patrick, there's no love lost between them. And Olivia Carter, we can tell early days, especially in the pub, that Patrick Morgan is the centre of her world, even though I'm not sure it's reciprocated. She's devastated when he's murdered.
You hear about the murder?
I'm investigating Patrick Morgan's death, yes.
You know it was Ralph Ford who did it.
Do I?
The man's crazy as a coot. He'd kill to get his hands on that cup, rip your throat out to win the prize.
And there was me thinking that bird watching was such an innocent pastime.
It's not a pastime, Inspector. It's a religion. Birders are a bunch of jealous, self-centered maniacs that cancel their own wedding for the glimpse of a rare bird.
And, what's in it for you, Miss Carter?
I just enjoy the exercise.
Yeah, the exercise, i.e. I had the hots for Patrick.
It must be great for Barnaby because, you know, in every episode, everybody in town does his work for them. They all know who did it. And they don't.
That's so true.
And they aren't afraid to tell him either, which I think is whether it was John Nettles or Neil Dudgeon. What I love about the character is that everybody feels so comfortable to talk to them and to share without him having to ask any questions.
Yeah, so true.
Now, GP Ian Markham claims his relationship with Nina was purely professional, of course, while fellow twitcher and former orchestral performer Michael Hipsman said he was playing his oboe at midnight, as we all do, on the night of Patrick's murder. Now, later the doctor visits Nina at her home to comfort her in her grief. Now, pictures of them together are delivered anonymously to Barnaby.
Where did you get these? Who took them? You've been following me.
Somebody sent them to us anonymously. Any comment?
Mrs. Morgan was stressed. She called me. She wanted a sedative. She's been through real trauma. She needed to talk.
Tea and cuddles, was it?
She was upset.
Would you like to have a second think about what you told me regarding how close you and she are?
No. All right. I hated Patrick Morgan. It wasn't personal. Everybody did. But I'm not the father of Mrs. Morgan's child, or her lover, or Patrick's killer. If you think I'm any of those things, you prove it.
Oh, don't worry, Doctor. If you are Patrick's killer, I will nail you for it.
I love it. Now that you've got the pictures, okay, I did hate Patrick Morgan, now that you mention it.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, in those pictures, it is photographs of him cuddling up with Nina.
Ralph and Morgan had this upset about this rare bird, yeah? This, hoopy. Well, Ralph did see it. I know, because I saw it too.
Oh, you a closet bird watcher now, Dave?
Yeah, whatever. But I shot a couple of rooks last week, but this other bird fell to earth as well. It was strange. It was sort of like a bluey brown colour. A hoopy. So I takes it to Ralph, I mean, because he buys any dead rare animal, stuffs them, sells them on.
So Ralph was telling the truth about spotting it?
Yeah. Only after I'd shot it stone dead. That's cheating, see? Because they can't claim a tick in their book if it's dead when they spot it. Listen, you want to get down Ralph Ford's workshop and shake his tree. Not mine.
You have the local bad boy who has no desire whatsoever to be associated with liking bird watching. Is like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, all he's interested in is earning a few bucks, isn't he? Foxley startles Ralph in the woods, demanding money to keep quiet, as he knows the truth about Ralph. Now, summoned by an emergency house call, Dr. Markham walks along the edge of the lake, never a good thing to do, and is ensnared by a mist net similar to the one Patrick's body was found in. A faceless perpetrator fires two shots from a shotgun, blasting the good doctor dead. Nina finally admits to the detectives the dead man was the father of her child. Yes, it was the doctor.
Well, Nikki, and you have to think watching this, you're sitting at home and you're saying, stay away from the edge of the lake. Nothing good happens near the edge of a lake. Now, cartridges from Foxley's gun magically match the ones found by Dr. Markham's body in the woods, but Foxley says they're from shooting vermin. Confronted, he concedes Ralph did find the rare hoopoe, but only after Foxley shot it down in error. Now, the detectives go to Ralph's workshop, find the hoopoe, but stuffed. The taxidermist may have lied, but he insists that he couldn't hurt another living creature, let alone the two dead men.
Did you see anyone else out by the lake last night?
No.
Do you want a shotgun, Tim?
Me? Yes. I do a bit of clay pigeon shooting occasionally. I keep it locked away.
Good. Mind if we take a look at it?
Well, actually, I'm running a bit late. It's Amy's ballet graduation class tonight.
It'll only take you a minute to get it, Mr. Whitley. It'd be very useful to us if we could eliminate it from our inquiries.
Yes, of course.
Just hold on.
Isn't it amazing how everybody who has something that Barnaby wants to look at, like, well, can we see it? Well, you know, I am really busy right now, so can we do this later?
Yeah. Do you know what? If there had been a death or two deaths in my local town or village and a chief inspector came knocking at the door and a detective sergeant, I'd be absolutely petrified. And the one thing you get time and time again is they're so relaxed about it. They say, oh, yes, a little bit later, I'm off on my way out. But they don't seem too phased or frightened.
Even if you know you didn't do it, it still would get to me.
Yeah, I'd be scared rigid. But of course, the boys are close to solving it.
This is the recording that Tim Whitley made on the night of Patrick's death. Now, there's the church bell striking midnight, then Patrick's cry, and a little later the splash. Yes?
Yeah, I remember all that.
What else can you hear?
Nothing.
Exactly. I think we've got our killer. Come on.
You remember when Tim Whitley told us about picking up the sound of the oboe whenever Michael Hipsman played it?
Yeah.
And Michael Hipsman told you that at the time of Patrick's death, he was at home playing the oboe. But if he had been playing his oboe, Tim Whitley's microphone would have picked it up. But it didn't. There was nothing on the recording.
So he wasn't playing it at the time of Patrick's death?
No. He was lying.
I think Nina's his next victim.
And off they run to try and save Nina before Michael Hipsman gets to her.
Well, I think, you know, when you think about all of the police procedural programs, it's always the butler who does it. Now I'm going to start my first question is like, is there an oboe player amongst you? Because you never trust the oboe player.
I love the fact that they've got such sophisticated recording equipment to chase after some birds that they can pick up things from like 2 or 3 miles away. So, Bill, one of the actors has caught my eye in a cameo role. I wonder if it's the same as the one I'm sure you're going to share with us.
Well, the first one that immediately came to mind was Ralph Ford, who is played by the actor James Dreyfuss. I recognize him from a number of different comedy series, one being Thin Blue Line, which was starred Rowan Atkinson,
yes.
But also Gimme, 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 and then more recently, Mount Pleasant.
Yeah, he is a superb actor. Really, really good.
This your hobby, Mr. Ford?
No, my profession. I'm a taxidermist. You'd be surprised at what people want to preserve and how much they're prepared to pay for it. You name it, I've stuffed it.
Now, there's another actor that I noticed. His name in the show was Dave Foxley, the local bad boy, good-looking bad boy as well. But actually, the actor is Paul Nichols, who, well, a lot of us over here will know from EastEnders. He played DS Sam Casey in the ITV drama Law and Order UK. And he was also in a Channel 4 drama, Ackley Bridge. But we all know and loved him as Joe Wicks in EastEnders. And he was a heartthrob back in the day, a total heartthrob.
So you noticed him as Paul Nichols, or you noticed him just because he was the local bad boy in Midsummer Murders?
Well, he really did have a huge role in EastEnders. He had some great lines. I'm not sure how long he was in it for, probably a couple of years, but as it's on nearly every single day, you know, he wouldn't have been able to have walked down the street without being recognized. I mean, as soon as he came onto the screen, I was like, oh, yeah, good actor.
What I've noticed in a lot of these episodes is that you do have a lot of people that have been pulled from EastEnders, The Bill, Doctors, people who are in it every day. So very recognizable individuals and actors.
Yeah, household names, as we would say.
What's the matter, Ralph? Dodgy ticker, have you?
I'm not surprised. That nasty secret you've been sitting on.
What do you mean? Well, you had a row with Morgan over that bird. Now, if I tell the world what went on there, we're in the sticky stuff. You wouldn't do that, would you, Dave? Rattle a few teacups around here, that wouldn't it? Please, Dave, please. Don't worry, Ralph. I don't rat on people, not even to the coppers.
I love that. You wouldn't do that, would you, Dave? Well, if there's money involved, yes, Dave would.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes. In each episode of Midsummer Murders Mayhem, we like to delve into our archives to hear from some of the people who made the show what it is. And this week, what a delight, we're hearing from Jason Hughes, otherwise known as DS Ben Jones. Now, he took over from DS Daniel Scott and helped the show transition from DCI Tom Barnaby to DCI John Barnaby. Jason was born in Wales in 1970 and joined the National Youth Theatre of Wales when he was 16. He actually lived in the same halls of residence as actor Michael Sheen before heading to London to study drama at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts. He landed the role in Midsummer Murders in 2005. But do you remember how he first came into the scene? Well, we'll let Jason explain.
Yeah, I thought it was just brilliant, the way that they did it.
No Scott this morning?
No, he called in sick. I'm on the arms.
I just showed up in a uniform and somebody said, well, where's the guy? And they were, oh, he's sick. And that was it. He was gone and I was in.
You possess a suit, Jones?
Yes, sir.
And a tie?
I do, sir, yes.
How do you fancy working with the CID for a couple of days?
Yes, sir.
And once he was part of the Midsummer Murders family, he got roped into all sorts of roles, such as when he had to dress up as a nun in a sacred trust.
The thing was is that because they knew I was stupid enough to say yes to pretty much anything that they threw at me, they just decided, well, let's do that then. And it also made my day more interesting. I feel like I was very lucky. I got to do so much fun stuff.
As I mentioned, D.S. Ben Jones was the detective sergeant who helped the show to transition from John Nettles to Neil Dudgeon. But how was it? Well, here's Jason Hughes explaining at the time how he was finding it.
Working with a new inspector, Neil, has been an absolute joy, I have to say. He's just such a lovely guy and he's incredibly kind. He works really hard. And he's trying his utmost to be as good as he possibly can. And what's really lovely is watching him grow into the part as well. It's really nice seeing him kind of get stuck into it more and exploring it more and becoming more and more confident about who this guy is.
Working with a new leading man meant that there were some adjustments to his role too.
The involvement of Jones in these scripts has definitely changed. He's got much more to do now, or at least he did have. I think because he was the bridge from the old to the new. So it was important, I think, for the audience. And also it worked contextually as well to have a linking device. And Jones is that device, you know, Jones is that link. And it worked. It's quite legitimate because there's a guy who comes from somewhere to work in a place and he's working with a guy who's grown up there and knows the area very well. So, you know, it's completely valid to have somebody take him around, show him what's what, where this is, the geography of the place, the kind of people that live there, the way things are done. So it all worked. And as a result, fortunately for me, as an actor, it was great because I got a lot more to do.
Now, we all know this show isn't particularly true to life, and Jason isn't ashamed to admit it.
We're not trying to be real. It's a made-up land. You know, these stories are fantastical, and we're not going to apologise for it. And I think that's probably something that people enjoy, because they're like, well, at least they're honest. They're not trying to be anything, you know, that they're not.
Well, the stories may be made up, but the settings certainly aren't, which is part, I think, of Midsummer Murder's unique charm. Jason Hughes.
We just ended up day after day after day after week in these most extraordinary locations. These incredible houses, houses that had these incredible grounds, beautiful farmland, beautiful forests, which is really quite an amazing thing for an actor to have that as your backdrop. It definitely makes your job easier. It's quite breathtaking.
But since he left the show, has he been back to the county of Midsummer?
When I think of my time on it, those 7 years, it's like I was in some kind of apocalyptic world where people just died all the time. I haven't been up that way for a while. Junction 2 to Junction 7 on the M40, I just divert, just go somewhere else.
That was the lovely Jason Hughes, otherwise known as D.S. Ben Jones. In each episode of Midsummer Murders Mayhem, we like to bring in the experts for you. Now, sometimes we have our in-house expert on the dead. Other times we chat to people who are involved behind the scenes or who can answer whether it really is possible to die by the means that they do on the show. This week, we're joined by Jamie Burntell. Now, if you've ever wondered if queer theory comes into Midsummer Murders or how to write the perfect crime, then guess what? Jamie is your man. His TED Talks education video, How to Write the Perfect Crime According to Agatha Christie, has been viewed over 300,000 times. I began by asking him what makes this type of whodunit, well, so popular.
As a crime writer, and at the heart of the best and most baffling mysteries, is simplicity. It's about having a simple pool of suspects, contained location, and a really baffling mystery that you can explain in three or four lines. It's about having something that feels really complex, but can actually be understood by pretty much anyone really easily.
But amongst the traditional crime novels, is it actually possible to weave in the themes of LGBTQ+ and also diversity?
Oh, yes. So a lot of people think of Agatha Christie, and a lot of people think of cozy crime fiction, perhaps, as a very old-fashioned genre where there's not necessarily much diversity. But if you scrape beneath the surface, you find a whole range of human emotions and behaviors going on, as there is in the real world, reflected in these books. The really key thing about a lot of crime writers is that they see through the social charade. They have to be able to see through prejudice and stereotypes in order to use them to shock the reader. So in a way, to write good crime fiction, you have to be really open-minded and outside all the kind of prejudices and moral panics going on at the time you're writing. It works with character types. It works with relationships too. The very first episode of Midsummer Murders plays brilliantly on the idea of a relationship that we as viewers wouldn't expect. Even if we're looking for a secret romance, there are two characters we wouldn't expect to end up together. And once you realize they are, that's the whole key to the mystery solved.
So, what do you think of the episode A Rare Bird?
I thought it contained elements of Midsummer Murders at its best. There was a lovely amount of slapstick comedy, a good strong mystery at the heart of it, and some wonderfully eccentric and rather unlikable in places characters.
Where were you late last night?
I was spark at. 5 pints and I'm nobody's.
Mr. Morgan was killed last night.
What? Never.
Mrs. Morgan, do you know her well?
Well, not as well as I'd like to. She fit or what, Jonesy, eh?
Now, obviously you've studied Agatha Christie's work and you know it inside out, but how do you think she compares to Caroline Graham?
I think Caroline Graham is one of the greatest crime writers of the 20th century. I think in creating Inspector Barnaby, she created a really new type of detective, but also a really new type of detective story that didn't just focus on the puzzle, or just focus on psychology, or just focus on violence. It provided a really good and cynical mix of psychology and puzzle and location.
What do you think is the appeal of the show?
Midsummer Murders is more English than any real English thing. There isn't really a place like Midsummer, but it's very nice to imagine there is. I mean, thank goodness, otherwise the homicide rate would be through the roof. But it's nice to escape into the relatively uncomplicated world of Midsummer Murders. And also, I think the quality of the writing they get is excellent. Any episode you sit down and watch, you recognize famous faces, perhaps playing the type of character you wouldn't expect them to play. So this real genius in Midsummer Murders, it's just the perfect export, if you like.
All right then, now, before we wrap up the interview, Jamie, what do you think is the perfect murder weapon?
I think the ideal weapon in Midsummer has to be something very English, maybe a jar of honey from the village fete or something like that. Some sort of ornament you'd find in a lovely cottage, a lovely English cottage, a lovely gardening ornament, something like that. These seem like completely random shock value ways to kill, but they're quite clever in a way because they show us that these pursuits we associate with the countryside, the idyllic English worldview of bird watching, which links instantly to hunting, of course, and the presence of rivers can be dangerous places. There's violence hidden in the most perfectly manicured lawn and the most perfectly clipped trees.
That was Jamie Burntell, who specializes in queer theory and wrote a TED educational talk all about how to write the perfect crime according to Agatha Christie.
It's now time for everybody's favourite segment of the podcast. It's the Midsummer Murder Superfan Face-Off Mega Quiz with me, Ashley. And today I'm joined by Caroline, who's in Scotland, and Bobby, who's in Philadelphia. Go Eagles! Caroline, I need you to give me a buzzer sound. Any sound you want.
Buzz.
Bobby, we don't have the money for buzzers here at the show, so you have to make your own sound. What's your sound?
I'll do the typical bee. Bzz.
So we're just going both buzzy bees?
Well, yeah, buzzy bees. Okay.
Yeah.
Very creative. Right. It is time for your questions. Are you ready, ladies?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. It's an easy one to start off with. Question number one. What is the name of the pub frequented in the episode A Rare Bird?
The Feathers.
Yes, Bobby.
The Feathers.
It is the Feathers. Bobby nails it. 1 point on the board for Bobby.
Oh.
It's a field goal. Okay. It's fine. Don't worry, Caroline. There's plenty of time. There's 10 questions. Question number two. The alleged sighting of which rare bird excites the village bird watchers? I'm going to go Caroline first.
Is it blue speckled hoopoe?
So close, but no coconut.
That's spotted.
Bobby.
Blue,
no.
Blue crested hoopoe.
It was the blue crested hoopoe, which also is weirdly my secret name on Tinder. Question number three. The gentle stroll that Sarah Barnaby plans and which John calls a route march is how many miles long?
Eight.
Yes, Bobby.
Eight?
It is 8 miles. Correct. Bobby's got game.
Bobby has such game.
Bobby's got Midsummer Murder knowledge coming out. Or I was going to say blue crested hoopoe, but that feels inappropriate. Question number four. Finish this sentence. I could never harm another living thing. I mean, I couldn't. I'm a...
Bzz.
Caroline.
Vegetarian?
It is vegetarian, Caroline.
Oh, if I only get one today, that'll be enough. I have some dignity.
Question number five. Which village does this episode take place in?
Bzz.
Bobby.
Midsummer in the Marsh.
Bobby, Midsummer in the Marsh. You did it. Question number six. Barnaby and Jones discuss the potential of an affair between Nina and another villager. What is the name of the D.H. Lawrence novel mentioned in this conversation? Caroline.
Lady Chatterley's Lover?
It's the big filthy novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover. Well done, Caroline. Question number seven. A Rare Bird is from season 14 of Midsummer Murders. How many episodes are in this season?
Bzz.
Caroline.
Eight.
She's got it in one.
Yes.
Come on, Caroline. Okay, question number eight. How much does the ice cream van charge Jones for two 99s?
Bzz.
Bobby.
A penny. Oh, wait.
No.
Oh, it says...
With the cost of dairy in this country, no, it's not a penny. No, Bobby. Caroline, have you got an answer?
I know it's a lot. I'm just going to go with a fiver, £5.
Oh. Close, but no coconut, Bobby. I'll come back to you for your final
I can't.
Shot.
I can't get it. I know it's like two for something and I can't get it.
Which means I get the point.
You get it.
Because the answer was £4.
Oh.
Which is too much for a 99. A 99 should be 99.
That's why I said 1. Yeah, 99. Okay.
Question number nine. In which season 19 episode does Jones make a guest appearance after being replaced by DS Charlie Nelson? Oh, Bobby was in first.
Last Man Out.
It is Last Man Out. It is. Oh, you two are really, really hardcore Midsummer Murder fans. This is exciting.
Oh, no, I think.
Final question. Are you ready, ladies? Take a breath. Final question. Which Tchaikovsky does the murderer take inspiration from? Caroline.
Swan Lake.
Dun, 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 dun. She's right. She's right. Dun, 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 dun. Okay. The scores are Bobby 4, Caroline 5, Ashley 1. Well done, me. Ladies, that was amazing. That was probably one of the most tense. Listeners, you can't see their faces, but never before have I seen two women look so concentrated on Midsummer Murders in my puff. That was great. Thank you so much, Caroline and Bobby. Well done, Caroline. You. Bobby, you fought valiantly.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Now, at the end of each episode, we like to wrap up so we can finally lay to rest and answer, well, who done it? As Nina leads her ballet pupils through their end-of-year concert, Sarah shows Barnaby footage of the ballerina in her prime. In the theatre, Barnaby spots a familiar face and realises the extent of the murderer's obsession. Remember that word, obsession.
And as Barnaby can, he rouses Jones to meet him at the concert to intercept Nina before she can be harmed. Well, they discover Nina's car has been tampered with, leading her to accept a ride from, you guessed it, the oboe player, Michael.
We find out the Hipsman played in the orchestra where Nina used to perform as one of the prima ballerinas, and he's had an obsession with her all that time and tracked her down to this village and is playing for her every single week when she goes to the village hall with the children to do dance classes, to do ballet classes. I mean, that's quite an obsession.
Well, don't forget the creepy shrine, too.
Barnaby and Jones rush to Hipsman's home, where they discover a shrine in the barn full of photographs of Nina as a ballerina. Barnaby remembers in the end of Swan Lake, the lead drowns with her lover Prince in a lake of tears.
What's that?
It's a circlet, Nina's circlet from the ballet Swan Lake. She threw it into the audience at the end of her final gala performance. And Michael caught it. And my guess is that now Michael will want to destroy her. When Odette, his innocent white swan, was made pregnant by Dr. Markham, she became Odile, the corrupted, the black swan.
You know, I have to think any time you discover a shrine in the barn, one, it's creepy, but
never good.
Gives you away. Now, the detectives make for the edge of Swansdown Lake. There they find Michael and Nina. Michael has Nina snared in a mist net again, barely conscious. Now, Barnaby keeps Michael distracted as Jones circles around the jetty. Just as Michael is about to toss Nina to her watery grave, Jones pounces on him as Jones can, plunging both men into the water.
You decided to kill Patrick? You did kill him, didn't you? Stay still, Nina!
Keep away from me!
No, Michael, wait, wait! Why did you send us those photographs? You were trying to throw suspicion onto Markham. But once you heard that Markham was the father of Nina's child, he had to go too, didn't he?
No!
So you shot him. You dropped those spent cases that you'd picked up in the woods. Cases from Dave Foxley's shotgun, trying to implicate him as well.
You seem to know everything, Inspector.
It's my job, Michael.
Then you'll know why Nina has to die in the lake. We'll both go down together. I and Odile.
No, Michael. She's innocent. She's still Odette. She's still the white swan.
No, no. Look at her. The black swan. We must drown together in the lake of tears.
The killer is apprehended. Barnaby and Jones sit in their office, admire the confiscated stuffed hoopoe, and toast a very rare bird indeed. In the next episode of Midsummer Murders Mayhem, Ashley and I'll be taking a walk on the culty side of life with the Oblong Murders.
How about going undercover on one of their induction courses?
No, I've got a week off, sir. I need it. I just popped in to...
I think this is what is called an amazing opportunity. Intelligence gathering skills, you see. The course has not been in vain. And it wouldn't do your promotion prospects any harm either.
We're going to be hearing from Jill Raddings, the trainer of Sykes, DCI John Barnaby's Jack Russell Cross.
Sykes had no limitations. He was what I call an all-singing, all-dancing dog.
And of course, Ashley will round things off with the superfan quiz.
Midsummer Murders Mayhem is presented by me, Nikki Chapman. A massive thank you to
Bill Young, Ashley Story,
and our guest,
Jason Hughes.
This has been an All Three Media international production, with special thanks to associate producers Rachel Blaister and Gary Wool. This series was created by Story Hunter. The executive producer was Kirsty Hunter, produced by Shannon Delwish. The production team was Pam Muir, Annie Abraham, and Reham Moussa.